everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Super duper.
We had some delicious lamb on Easter Sunday, and it came from DeBraga and Spittler, our meat purveyor, who we went on a tour of these guys. A guy named George Faison, who you heard us talk about on the show before. He is an activist for humane animal treatment. Mm-hmm.
George, we did a show with George just a few months ago.
Fantastic.
But realize that George's original facility, or DeBraga and Spittler, their original facility was in the meat market in Manhattan.
And they're kicking all the meat purveyors out there because there are too many trendy club kids that want to go there.
And it's way too valuable real estate to be a meat market anymore. But, you know, I would go there. You know, I used to go there when I would go to Fulton Street. We would go to Fulton Street.
Make a
fish run first, and then the meat market would be opening on your way back from getting fish, so you could make another stop into the meat market and pick up the day's meat. And that was in the days when DeBraga didn't deliver to New Jersey. And so, you know, if I wanted that particular purveyor's meat, I had to stop and get it myself. So I did. But when you talk about the difference in their, they just opened a new facility in Jersey City, and you talk about the difference, you know, talk about upgrading.
Oh my goodness!
You know, they've changed the way they do things so much, and it's such a modernized facility when you compare it to, you know, the old meat market that was built in, you know, the early 1900s.
And you also look at what DeBraga has done, and we often talk about winemakers who do this. You know, they use technology to make it possible to make the meat in the old-fashioned way that they always made it. You know what I mean? Really, but that's what it is.
Yes, absolutely.
The storage is modern, the labeling is modern, the tracking is modern, the moving boxes around is modern, the cleaning is modern.
But there's a lot of using what's modern also to prevent people from dying from the...
Yeah. Well, but you know what? It's everything's extra clean, everything. But the way they age meat is still the expensive old way to age meat. And it was just wonderful to be able to go on a tour. And we went with our chef who used to work for us, Anthony Bucco. We went with our current chef and sous chef. And we met a couple of other Jersey chefs up there with whom we're very friendly. And, you know, we looked at the fresh meat just in the beginning of the aging process, the 7-day, the 14-day, the 28-day, the 45-day, the 60-day aged different kinds of meat. And it was really fascinating. It gives you a real appreciation for it. It's really an artisan thing that we don't do in-house. And then, frankly, even restaurants that age their own steaks, you can't age them like they do at DeBraga and Spittler.
What was really interesting to me, and, you know, obviously something you know, when you think about it, and being in the business, I think about it a lot. But there's a cost to aging meat, and some people think that it's just the time value of the money,
right?
That you know, from
60 days
days
to wait.
I can sell you this right now, or I can sell you this in 60 days. It costs me more to sell you it in 60 days. But there's more to that with the aging of the meat,
right?
Because you lose, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20% of the weight of the meat, and that was fun too, because what we did is we weighed, you know, the 10-pound, you know, the rack of...
Right. They label the piece. One of their tight controls they have at DeBraga, which is really great, which I don't think a lot of butchers have. But it comes in. The piece of meat is labeled. You know exactly where it's from, exactly what farm it's from.
And you know what it weighed when it came in.
And then at 10 days, you can weigh it again. And so we went pulling pieces of meat. You know, we were all dressed sterilely, and we were weighing them at different parts of the aging process. And it was just fascinating to really see that hands-on.
Right, see exactly what was going on, and to be able to touch the meat and say, okay, this is what 7-day dry age tastes like, or should feel like, a strip loin. This is what a 14-day age, this is what a 21-day age, and how different they are, and they look different, and they feel different, and they taste different.
And I have long suspected, and now I actually have a better understanding than I ever did, and we had a pretty good understanding of aged meat, because we've been selling aged beef for a long time, but I now know, I know places who are writing on their menu that they are having aged steak,
absolutely.
And I'm like, absolutely not.
Well, aged, but not aged to the degree they say.
And I used to be able to tell, because basically if you have somebody who says they have a 28-day aged steak and you cut into that steak and it expresses, you know, that red watery liquid on the plate, they're lying to you.
Right, because that's part of the weight that goes away, that the water, that liquid, you know, evaporates.
But I now have a better feel for what things should feel like, look like at different stages of the aging process.
You know, there's, you know, Francis and I have said this before about lots of different things that, that you come across. The best way to do a real test and to really learn is to put things side by side.
Yeah.
And whether you're tasting two rums, so, you know, Francis and I did a rum tasting yesterday. We were tasting between two rums. Put the rum side by side.
Yep.
And don't go by memory and don't go by what I think and don't go by, you know, my preconceived notion. Put them side by side, taste them, and
right.
Let's see what the differences are.
And then
are.
Do it again blind and see
and
if you
And then do it again
it.
Without knowing what's what. And going through the steaks and touching them and looking at them and having all of that side by side is an educational experience.
Well, and we haven't even spoken to George about it yet, but I really want to have him come down, and I want to do, like, in a cookout scenario, some sort of scenario where we can open up to people the different levels. Because, and some of these are really expensive. I mean, what would the 60-day aged Wagyu cost? We figured that out. That would cost us, it would cost retail, what would that cost?
Retail, $70 a pound.
$70.
Like that.
For
that's
the
for American Wagyu.
Yeah, for aged American Wagyu.
Right.
But, you know, when you look at it and you see what it is and what it's become, you know, it makes sense. I mean, he was very transparent about his pricing, and you think, well, you know, sometimes stuff is expensive because it comes in with a certain label on it. Sometimes stuff is expensive because, well, it's expensive to get there, but boy, is it worth it in the end. Hey, listen, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to talk with Paul Verrant. He's an amazing chef from Chicago. He's got a new book out, and you need to know about it. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Paul Verrant. Chef Verrant owns a couple of restaurants out in Chicago. He's cooked in New York and around the world, and his new book talks about the unique aspect of his Michelin-starred restaurant, V, in Chicago. It's called The Preservation Kitchen, The Craft of Making and Cooking with Pickles, Preserves, and Agri-Doux.
Hey, Paul, it's great to finally get you on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
We have been fans of your cooking vicariously for a long time, and we've certainly read about you. Congratulations on your Michelin star. That was really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, we were, I think the entire city was pretty jazzed about having Michelin come into town.
Yeah, and well, and you're not, like, right in city center, right? You're out of Chicago, outside.
We're not, yeah. V is in Western Springs. It's about 25 minutes, half an hour or so, like a little southwest of the Chicago Loop area. So, and we've been here, it'll be 8 years this fall, actually.
We are big believers that Michelin should travel 30 to 40 minutes outside major cities and go to the restaurants just outside.
We are 40 minutes
out. Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
But it's also self-serving. We're about 40 minutes outside of Manhattan. So, Mark is trying to, if you're a Michelin reviewer and listening, let's put a bug in your ear. Let's talk about, first and foremost, your idea of preserving and the idea behind the cuisine of V. I mean, you put up a ton of food.
We do. It's been a part of the restaurant ever since we opened. I mean, when we opened the doors in 2004, you know, I had a ton of stuff that I had put up at home. I think initially it was kind of a food hobby that gradually over time became something that I incorporated more and more into my cooking and baking. So it was a mission from day one at V to cook very seasonally and to use stuff when it's fresh at their peak, but also to put up and preserve as much as we could to have the opportunity to use these things in the off season.
Well, that's really the great conundrum, I think, when we opened what was trying to be a seasonal restaurant in 1992. And it was nearly impossible thing to do because we're in New Jersey, you're in Chicago. We have great produce 6, 7, maybe even 8 months a year. We can get some really cool stuff.
Well, and people didn't really react well to the all potato menu in January.
Right, exactly.
You know,
right? Yeah, roots and tubers for
5 months.
Potato leek soup followed by Jules Rimmel artichokes and some winter carrots.
Right, which I love all that stuff.
It's wonderful, but having this avenue and Francis and I really decided that we were going to take a big look at preserving foods when we opened our Italian American restaurant in 05, around that same time that you were looking at doing it.
Wow.
And we said, you know, we are in New Jersey, the capital of tomatoes, and we're opening a Brooklyn Italian restaurant was our second restaurant. we have to do something about having Jersey tomatoes in our restaurants all the time, like my grandmother did.
And though it was a bit of a cliche, it was like, Mark, we wanted to do everything like Catherine Lombardi's food. Catherine Lombardi's the name of the restaurant. And so we put up thousands of pounds of tomatoes, and we actually wear a house coat when we're making – no. it's a little
Grandma, I have to say, Grandma had lots of house coats.
Yeah, of course she did.
She had like seven of them hanging over the back of the pantry.
There you go.
For Monday house coat.
So
that's cool that you guys have done that. I mean, you know, those – I mean, you know, just having spent a little time out east, I mean, I know, you know, the – I mean, you know, there are some people that maybe that are a little close – that are a little close-minded, that don't see and appreciate the beauty and the agriculture capability of Jersey, but I'm a fan, and I mean, like the corn and the tomatoes and the blueberries, the stuff is legendary.
It's the Garden State, man.
I'm a big fan. So that's really cool that you guys have done that.
There are things that Jersey definitely does really well, but the proof is in the pudding, and I'm sure that's why you put all the effort, same types of effort that we put in. When you harvest something really fresh and can it, and it's perfect when you can it, that shows in the end product. I mean, We buy canned tomatoes. We buy lots of, you know, we augment our tomatoes with other canned tomatoes. But there's nothing like the tomatoes that we picked, that we put up. There's just no comparing it to anything you can buy.
I agree. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, I think canning is a little bit like if you've ever gotten into like making beer or wine or breads. You know, it's like that. You know, it's something that you make, and then it takes a little time to either ferment or kind of age, and then the anticipation of, you know, what it's going to be like, and then finally you open it. Maybe it's in the winter time, and it's like, you know, it's a real accomplishment.
I'm going to just say one thing though that I think is different about making your own beer or making your own wine. They usually suck.
Yeah.
So, but canning your own fruits and vegetables are usually way better than anything you can get.
I'm sure there's home winemaker and brewers all over that would not agree with you.
Well, that's because go ahead.
But I was gonna say, but I've actually done a little bit of fermenting in the past, and I first learned how to make wine in college in West Virginia, and basically I had gotten some wine yeast from a local winemaker, and I pitched a yeast in a jar of Concord grape juice, like from Welch's.
Yeah,
it was brutal.
Yeah,
we drank it all, and you know, had a headache for days after. But
how did your Manischewitz take turn out?
I, for 2 years running, judged the home wine contest with the wine writer at the time of the Star Ledger, T.J. Fodoraro. And I did that. It was a punishment for as a favor to a friend, I'll tell you. And here's what I'll say to most home winemakers is, you know, I know you love your wine and your grandpa's wine.
Right.
And I know you think it's fabulous. Just like you think your kids are smarter than everyone else's. That's why you like it, because it's yours.
But it is yours, and it is fabulous, and I do encourage people to make their own wine and their own beer. Just recognize that I'm probably not going to make this
one. So turn that over, though, to the restaurant. Can you talk to us about how this works at V in Chicago? What, you know, how much are you putting up? How much of it is on the plate? What's the philosophy that guides you? I mean, this is kind of your signature thing.
Yeah, I mean, we probably, I mean, really – beginning, you know, I mean, this year it's been earlier, but typically we begin kind of the 1st of April with ramps, and then we go, you know, we go to the end of September, October, with pretty hardcore canning, and then of course, you know, beyond that it kind of dies off, and we do some things with, you know, with citrus and stuff over the winter time. Celery root and, you know, some other roots and things. But it's probably, I mean, at both of my restaurants, it's probably anywhere from, you know, maybe 50 to 100 quart jars once the growing season starts of what we're doing each week. And then the idea is, you know, it's I mean, really, it all comes down to the balancing act of having something that's acidic that balances with a component on a dish that maybe is rich or it's a protein or it's fatty, and it adds kind of like a spark or adds some interest to the plate. So, you know, we're opening jars of pickles and things like that, and it's an accompaniment. I mean, you know, we're taking pickled fennel and we're using some of the brine and some butter, some olive oil and herbs, and glazing, you know, fish or roasted meat with it. You know, I mean, of course we do some traditional you know, garnishing or preparations too. You know, whether it's like you know pickles or something along with with charcuterie or mostardas and stuff that we make. I mean, so there are things that are just open a jar and spoon on the plate and serve. But then there's a whole ton of other things where we're doing, like I said, like we're glazing things, or we're doing like a reduction sauce with a cipollini agridue, and then finishing the sauce with the cipollinis. So I would like to think that it's kind of a signature you know style of cooking that we do, and it just adds something different. It adds kind of the unexpected on a plate.
Paul, I want to talk more about the finished product in just a second, but before we go there, I want to talk a little bit about how the restaurateur gets to participate with the farmer when he's doing when the restaurateur is canning and pickling, and you really do participate in what's happening in the farmer's life. When it's a bad strawberry season, when it's last year we had the experience with Hurricane Irene here in New Jersey, happened at the end of August, and tomatoes were done because most of the tomatoes just got literally blown away. We lost four weeks of our tomato season.
That's so devastating.
It was devastating. So instead of 8 or 10,000 pounds of tomatoes last year, we put up 5 or 6,000 pounds, and now we're running out.
Right.
So you really do in the restaurant business, and I want to know if you're experiencing the same thing. Get to participate in the good things that happen on the farm and some of the trials and tribulations that they go through at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, I think most definitely that is the case. I mean, I think where we've dealt with it is with being flexible on the menu. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, over the almost 8 years that we've been open, we've gotten to a point where we've kind of dialed in on like a standard selection of these canned items that we know we're going to use a ton of. So, you know, it could be, you know, I mean, as flexible as we are, I mean, it could be a real issue, and you definitely, like, I mean, you know, this year in the Midwest, I mean, we're pushing like 5 weeks ahead of years past. I mean, we've had ramps on the menu for the last, you know, 3 weeks, almost 4 weeks, and we usually don't see ramps until the end of March.
Yeah.
So if, you know, like the next couple nights they're calling for a frost, I mean, it could be devastating for all the fruit trees, like in Michigan and stuff. So it could definitely have a significant impact on what we do.
Well, I think that one of the things that's interesting about canning is, you know, it also gives you great flexibility as a chef, and it gives, you know, anybody who does it at home great flexibility at home. What's the old adage? Actually, you quote it in your book. It's I eat what I can.
Yeah, eat what you can what you can.
And, you know, that allows you to work with a farmer and say, hey, listen, you know, plant this for me, and when you get it in, I'll take it all. Because that's the big thing about a farmer, right? You know, if you grow wheat or corn, it's storable. But if you grow vegetables,
right,
you know, it's ripe now. You have 9 days to sell it. Go, you know. And if you as a restaurant can say, hey, listen, I'll take it all, and what I can't use, I'll put up. It's just, you know, farmers love it.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm sure you guys have it out east as well. But I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there are plenty of farmers too that are getting into creating kind of the value added things that they can produce on their farm. You know, so they're selling fresh things, but if they can get into preservation, you know, like drying some of their fruit, freezing some of their sweet corn, that's smart because they I think they say it's something like 30% of what a farmer grows. You know, if it's a versatile vegetable or fruit farmer, 30% of it goes into the compost. You know, economically, obviously, it benefits them if they can have a guaranteed sale on maybe more than what they would typically sell, because we're gonna can a bunch, but it also could benefit us too, because we could maybe drive the price down.
Well, you know, it's funny. That's one of the things that we do when we talk with farmers. We sort of can negotiate a price in advance, but it's based on the. When it comes up, we will take it all, no matter what month it is, what week it is. You know, because we've had
feeling.
Well, and before we used to put stuff up, you know, something would come in the week before Memorial Day weekend. Well, I'm dead on Memorial Day weekend. I don't need customers coming in. If I buy 20 flats of that, they're just going to rot in my walk-in.
Right.
Until,
if the strawberries just came in,
but now you're
sunk.
But now you preserve them. Let me ask you, what is kind of the thing that is really popular and shocking when people go into your restaurant and they're just blown away by things that you preserve? What are the things that really tickle people?
That kind of stand out.
Yeah.
I think overall it's like I was talking about before, like kind of the unexpected level of acidity that's on a plate. Like, I mean, that's kind of the general you know, it's hard for me to think of maybe one particular item or a few items that are different. You know, we do use a lot of preserves and things in cocktails. So we've had we have a Manhattan on the menu that, you know, instead of a sweet vermouth, we make a beer jam out of a local imperial stout from Goose Island. They make a Bourbon County stout, and it's aged in bourbon barrels. So we make the jam out of the beer, and that's the vermouth in the Manhattan, you know, along with a Buffalo Trace, some bitters, and then brandy cherry juice that we also do in house. And it's been kind of a signature cocktail for years now, and it's, you know, it's cool. But I guess it's hard to think about other, like, specific canned items that, you know, I mean, we do a lot of the combination of, like, fresh vegetables and their pickled counterpart, you know. So, like, in the summertime, like, wood-grilled summer beans that are picked up with a little bit of, like, you know, pickled beans, you know, and then, like, maybe some herbs. And so that's kind of a nice, like, so you're eating it and you're like, oh, this is, you know, and then you get that contrast.
Right, this year and last year, kind of a
this
thing
year,
on the plate.
Yeah,
we did a dish one time with fresh peaches, the peaches that we put up a year ago, and then the peaches that we put up 2 years ago. And so you could see the contrast in you know, what happened to them over time. Was really
that's
cool.
Cool.
Dish. Was a really cool dish.
Yeah, that's really neat.
Now let's talk about, you said we talked about acid a lot, and we should point out that there are a lot of different kinds of canning. If you're going to can at home, you really need to do some research, because there are some dangers involved in canning. And some of them can be, some of the problems with canning at home, and again, people have done it for thousands of years.
Sure.
But some of the problems with canning at home are, yeah, there are things that go wrong and your jar explodes or your jar gets cloudy or there's mold on top and you can see that there's something wrong. But things can go wrong at home that are invisible, and those are actually the more dangerous things. You want to talk to us about what the dangers are and how we avoid them?
Yeah, I mean, the big issue with canning, and it really relates to, you know, if you're doing like any water bath canning or processing, and if you're making pickles or you're what's referred to as you're acidifying the foods, you need to have, you know, a pH equilibrium, meaning like the mixture, you know, whatever the item is, the fruit or vegetable, and the brine itself, all needs to have a pH of 4.6 or less. Now, anything higher than that could potentially contain botulism. You know, and botulism is a bacteria that grows without any oxygen, so it's anaerobic. And at that point, you know, if the pH is not low enough, it can produce a deadly toxin that, you know, I mean, could potentially kill you. So, you know, so does that mean you have to have a pH meter and test all your batches? And I think it means that if you get into canning enough, I would recommend it.
Sure.
But I think the key is having a good recipe and not deviating from the recipe.
And I just want to point out that a lot of people have like great grandma's recipe around.
Right.
You know, I would check great grandma's recipe against modern standards because
I mean, hitting the right temperature, those types of things for the right amount of time, they're very important issues.
And also remember, you don't get botulism every time you do it wrong. You get botulism 1 in 1,000 times you do it wrong. So grandma may have only killed one person 75 years ago that they didn't know what it was from, but you don't want to take that chance. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and botulism, you know, the bacteria itself is like found like in soil. You
right.
know? So you're right. I mean, it's not on everything. You
right.
know?
Well, and there what you get is you get botulinum spores, and the spores you can ingest and they don't hurt you. The problem is if the botulinum spores are put in the right environment, you know, and like a high pH anaerobic environment is sort of like going to the Spanish Riviera for botulinum spores. They grow, they have a great time, and they create this toxin that will kill you.
This is the
right.
best show ever.
Fun with food with Mark and Francis.
Yeah, but you know, the thing about it is like what inspired a lot of my canning was, you know, stuff that my grandmothers did. A lot of old American cookbooks. I think there is some value to some of those older recipes too. You just have to be cautious. I think, you know, like you said, I mean, people have been doing this for over 100 years, and it just, you know, I think it's a little bit. I mean, you have to be careful.
Yep.
It's a little bit of people being like hyper about food and food safety as well.
Which
is important. You know, but
you just need to spend some time learning about what you're doing.
Right.
It is. You know, I feel like at least in the United States, I mean, things are a little bit more like, you know, it's a little more regulated than other parts of the world, and I think that's great to a certain extent, you know. But you know, the husband and wife that have been canning their stuff in Alsace for 50 years and have never had an issue, you know, I think there's something to be said for that too.
They're probably doing it right.
Right, and they wouldn't be allowed to do that, what they do in the United States.
No. But, you know, in the case, I mean, obviously, like, as a restaurateur, you know, I want to make sure my stuff is A-okay.
Absolutely. Hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back on the other side with Paul Varant of Restaurant V in Chicago. His new book is The Preservation Kitchen. You can find out more about it at restaurantguysradio.com. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and The Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome, but it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo, for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional, and that can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're having a great conversation about canning and preservation with Michelin-starred chef Paul Varant. I want to talk to you, Paul, about – we do something unusual. We put a lot of stuff up with alcohol, which is – that's actually sort of how we got into it, the tomatoes. And we had a friend who is actually now a super scientist who, you know, is one of the top geologists in the world. He always used to give us at Christmas time different fruits preserved in liquor. So, you know,
nice.
Quince and apples put up in Applejack or Cognac. And so that's sort of how we started. So we started from the bar and then went to the kitchen.
Yeah, he was kind of a meteorite studying Calvados apple guy.
Yeah. He's pretty smart. Anyway, so I see that you put up Black Mission figs and brandy in your book. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us about the role of alcohol and the role of alcohol in the safety of it. Does that enhance – does alcohol have any – safety properties, like we know that acid does and heat does and sugar does. What role does the alcohol play besides deliciousness?
Well, alcohol is definitely a preserving agent. So I think it's probably almost foolproof that you can preserve fresh fruit in alcohol.
Francis and I are big fans of foolproof, by the way.
Also
yeah,
big fans
no,
of alcohol.
I remember years ago doing like a brandy with rhubarb, and it's, you know, there's no canning involved. I mean, you can put it in jars, but there's no, you know, you don't necessarily have to process it. You know, we do. I mean, as far as in the book, we do a number of different fruits that we do, like a brandy. I mean, it's a brandy syrup. We do cherries, we do peaches, we do figs. You know, and we've done some other stuff too. You know, plums that we dehydrate. You know, to make prunes, and then we brandy the prunes, you know. And then the other big component in the book where we're using alcohol is in the agridoo, which is, you know, a sweet and sour liquid that typically contains, you know, wine, vinegar, you know, some sort of, you know, like sweetener, herb, spices, and salt. So, and we do, there are a few vegetables that we do with that, you know, onions and cipollinis, and you know, we've done carrots and beets, but it's mostly for fruits, you know, and it's a great, I mean, they're like, we use a lot of the fruit based agridoos, like in cocktail, like in shrubs,
mm-hmm.
or cobblers. So
just,
I mean,
so everybody knows, he's not, those are types of cocktails. Paul's not talking about shrubs and desserts.
Yeah, I'm not.
Bushes
talking
and
about,
desserts
I'm not talking
are not
about
what he's
bushes
talking.
And yeah.
Those are types of cocktails.
That's right. So and that's a, you know, I mean, it's like a whole new world, you know, and it's a lot of fun, and those drinks are all, you know, typically very kind of refreshing and bright.
Well, you know, one of the things we find with our alcohol-preserved fruits is that it only makes sense, especially if you use good alcohol, if we then use the liquid. You have to get 100% yield out of that. You use the fruits either in the kitchen or behind the bar, and the liquid behind the bar, and those are fairly dear.
That's key. I mean, and that's one of the other things about the book too, is we, even with the pickles and stuff, it's, you know, we don't pitch the brines. I mean, that's, you know, we try to incorporate everything, you know, because it's not, you know, what goes into the jar is not cheap.
Well, it's expensive and time consuming. You want to use everything that you can use out of that, and you take care of all the aspects of it to make sure that everything comes out as a usable product.
Yes.
You know, that's one of the things that I'd love to ask you about. We have found that putting stuff up in the summertime means we get to take advantage of some very well-priced, really delicious produce. And I'm not talking about the alcohol stuff. I'm talking about tomatoes and vegetables that we put up. But honestly, we found that by the time we spend the labor and the equipment and the storage and, you know, every once in a while it goes wrong and you have to...
Jars and the new lids every year. And the
And every once in a while, you know, you have to... You make a mistake and a batch goes, you know. It's not inexpensive. You know, we found that our tomatoes, our jars of tomatoes are costing us about, when we figure in the labor, and you have to figure in the labor, they're about $22 a jar. I mean, we big jars, but...
Yeah, half gallon.
Half gallon jars.
But that ain't cheap. You know, it's not like it's cheaper than buying this stuff. There's a reason that people buy canned stuff. It's more convenient and cheaper. Do you find that to be the case as well?
It's not inexpensive. I mean, we've done you know, over the last couple of years, we finally have really gotten into, you know, what is all this stuff costing. You know, some of the more expensive are like the white asparagus, artichokes, ramps, you know, like are typically over $10 a quart, you know, our cost.
That's wholesale cost.
And that doesn't factor in labor.
Right. So add $5 a jar, $4 a jar for labor, and you know, you realize that it's, you know, if you're at home and you have the time, it's, you know, you can do it inexpensively. But
and it's
not
a labor of love. It's right. Not just it's
and,
not
and
just
it's a
labor.
And it's a fun thing to do. But you know, in the summertime, I got six guys in the kitchen covered in tomato sauce. You know, that's not inexpensive. So you don't do it just because it's cheaper. You do it because it's, you know, special and it's unique and it's yours.
Yeah, I agree.
All right,
and you know, and you're also, you know, like we talked about before. I mean, you're supporting, you know, a local farmer, artisan. You know, that's a huge part of it too. And you have that connection where you know these people that are growing or raising or doing these things for you. But you know, but at the end of the day, it's not. I mean, but then again, I'd rather almost spend that than you know, compared to spending the same amount to get strawberries or something like in February, where the quality is
right
considerably less.
Absolutely.
Know? So, you know, I mean, it's, you know, we're all not, you know, we're in an area in the country where the growing seasons are very distinct.
And you know what your grandma said is, you know, when as far as the short growing season, when life gives you lemons, preserve them.
I love that.
You know? Hey, all right, we're sort of running a little short on time.
Okay.
But I don't want to end the program until we talk about some of the things that, I mean, everyone sort of remembers grandma put up fruits and grandma put up tomatoes.
Right.
But you put up some unusual things. Not everybody put up low pH stuff. And I just like for you to talk for a minute about, there are two things. One is preserving mushrooms. Your preserved mushrooms look great. And the milk jam looks really phenomenal.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
So, but when you do that, you have to use a pressure canner.
That's correct.
Can you talk about why some things require a pressure canner and what a pressure canner does?
Basically, a pressure canner is when you're preserving something that doesn't have a pH low enough, doesn't have, you know, the 4.6 or less. So you have to pressure can it, and what that's doing, it's you know, by adding, like, typically at sea level, you know, you're adding 10 pounds of pressure on the canner, it raises the boiling temperature or the internal temperature of the canning, you know, of the pressure canning pot to 248 degrees, so it's hot enough to kill, you know, any botulism spores.
So let's point out that if you put in a water bath and you sterilize all you want, if your acid isn't high, that will heat alone, the boiling temperature of water,
right, 212,
will not kill botulinum spores. And if you put enough acid in there, it will. But if you don't have enough acid, you got to raise the temperature to 248. And the only way to do that
is
with a pressure canner. So
that's correct.
As they used to say in Hill Street Blues, since we're talking about Chicago. And hey, let's be careful out there.
That's right. And a pressure canner. I mean, a lot of people are intimidated by the canners. But again, it's like anything else. Like, follow instructions. I mean, there's a pretty detailed list of instructions in the book, you know. Don't have ADD and stay on point and focus on the instructions, and it shouldn't be an issue.
And pressure canners and pressure cookers aren't like the ones that came out in the 70s that are apt to explode anymore.
The world
has changed a little bit. They're usually pretty safe.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. I mean, it's not a bomb.
And hey, you know, we have a lot of folks who listen in the restaurant business. If you want to try this in your kitchen or behind your bar, you need to just pay attention. And what you need to do is either you, the most responsible person in your kitchen, need to watch this from beginning to end to make sure that if you're using a water bath, the jars are covered, it's there for the appropriate amount of time. And if you're going to assign somebody, make sure there's a responsible person assigned from beginning to end. Don't let four dishwashers, you know, say, here, do this, and then bring it to me in the end. And what we've instituted is when a batch of jars gets done, someone in a position of authority initials each batch with the date and the label, and that way you'll hold somebody accountable.
Yeah, that's a good thing. You gotta log everything.
Paul Verrant, it was a pleasure talking
Gentlemen,
with you.
Yeah,
you.
Really, really terrific book. The best one I've ever seen of its type.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, man. Appreciate it.
Great. Listen out there in listener land, if you're anywhere near Chicago and you don't make a beeline for Restaurant V, you're foolish. You can find out more about Paul Verrant, Restaurant V, and the Preservation Kitchen on our website at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. I really dig. This book is phenomenal.
It's great. And I'll tell you right now, as much as we do with canning and preserving and all those other things, and you've heard us talk about it a lot, this book will be a resource for us, no question about it.
You know, one of the things he talked about was agrodoux, which mm-hmm. is the sweet and sour that you're left over with the brining liquid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if it's not too salty, it can be really, you know, of course, you're the canner, so you get to decide whether it's too salty or not. But, you know, that has a large tradition in a lot of cuisines. I mean, the Sicilian cuisine is agrodolce, right, which means the same mm-hmm. thing. And it's surprising, or you might find it surprising, what a little bit of acid, or how important a good amount of acid on the plate really is.
You know, in Kathleen Lombardi, we make an old traditional dish called veal marsala, and we use real traditional marsala, sweet marsala in it. And there are two things that I think that Italian restaurants, the mistake that they make when they make that dish. One is they either don't use a real marsala and they use a salted marsala, which is awful.
Kitchen wine.
Which they buy in a grocery store, and it's disgusting.
It's if you buy your marsala in the grocery store and it's made in carne, there's no marsala made in carne.
But the other thing is they don't add any acid to that dish, and you've got to add – and we use it – actually, we in our Italian dish, we use a little sherry vinegar
yep.
in that dish because the dish needs acid. It can't all be about sweet.
Right.
It's also – whenever you have sweet in a savory dish, you've got to have acid to balance it.
That's
period.
True.
Or a savory wine.
Right, absolutely. Or a cocktail, you know. Mm-hmm. And the book is amazing, and it lets you can really tackle things at whatever level you want. You don't need to buy a pressure canner. You can start with making some jams and butters, and you can make them in small batches with what you have in the kitchen if you buy a couple of mason jars. I really recommend the book.
The book's got a whole array of different types of skill levels here.
And the other thing about this book is it then gives you recipes about how to use what you've preserved mm-hmm. on a dinner plate, which is lacking in other books that talk about canning and preserving. It's they all want you to put it on the pot roast.
You know, we were turned on to Paul by a mutual friend, a regular customer of his and ours. Imagine that, in Chicago and New Jersey.
Yeah.
And it clearly really cool stuff that he's doing.
Well, let's go to our restaurant and see if we can't preserve something, Mark. What do you say?
Great idea.
You just made a face. They can't see it in the radio land, but you just made a face at me. Like, that's the corniest thing anybody ever said.
That was – I hope that people caught it in my inflection.
Man, we're going to have to do a video broadcast to see that. That was really nasty. Anyway, hope you guys have enjoyed this last hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We're the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com.